We're ready whenever you are, counsel. And Green River Media Communications versus Northland Cable.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Len McPhee. I'm here appearing on behalf of the appellants. I'd also like to introduce Michael Sink of my firm, who's assisted on the briefs. We're here today in connection with three separate and fully integrated asset purchase agreements for the sale of seven cable systems. Green River, the purchaser, failed to tender the purchase price for any of those three, under any of those three contracts on March 31st, 2008. That was the date that was agreed upon by the parties to be the closing date. It was also a date agreed upon in each of these agreements by which either party could terminate if the conditions to close had not been met by that date. Importantly, the failure to close by Green River was not caused by any breach, action, or inaction.
Is it your position, and I don't know if the record reflects it at all, that if the purchaser, recognizing in mid-March they didn't have enough cash to buy all the properties but could buy, say, the major one, was that separately saleable?
Absolutely.
That's your position now. Was that your position then?
It was, and it needed to be, because that's how
the
contracts
were. The trial court said it was intended to be a single transaction, and therefore the parties intended this to really be one contract, but because there were three entities involved in the ownership, required three contracts. What do we do with that finding?
I think, first of all, it's not a factual finding, but rather it is a contract interpretation issue, and therefore it is a legal conclusion reviewed de novo. Second, we need to look, therefore, at each of those three contracts to determine the party's intent. In each of those three contracts, there was a merger and integration clause, which specifically stated that this contract is the entire agreement between the parties. If you go back to the first paragraph of the contract, the parties are NCP7 and Green River, NCP8 and Green River, and NCPI and Green River in each of those three separate contracts. So this is, again, a de novo review based on contract interpretation principles. As we cited in our briefs, when you have a merger and integration clause like the one present in each of these three contracts, then, and it's clear and unambiguous, then plural evidence cannot even be looked at to try to deviate from the clear contract terms and the intent of the parties as the court is to determine it based on those clear contract terms. Further, the contracts could have, and if the parties truly intended one to be conditioned on the other, could have so indicated. Certainly, I would suspect that Your Honors have seen such transactions where parties have multiple documents and they incorporate one into the other, or make conditions of one or terms of one a condition on performance in one of the other contracts. In this instance, there's an absence of any such language, and therefore the clear merger and integration clause is the evidence, if you will. It is the clear contract terms, and therefore the court's statement, which is the one of the primary issues that we're raising on appeal, that this was intended to be one transaction, is a clear error of law.
Well, I presume that you would agree that it was anticipated that these three contracts would be closed substantially simultaneously.
I think that's a fair characterization under the context or heading of logistics.
Yeah, I understand that. What you're saying is, while it may have been anticipated, you're asserting that there was no legal requirement that be so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Indeed, the parties, if the parties had so intended, that they would have put that in their contracts, and they did not. And therefore, Green River could have and should have, if it intended to go forward and comply with its obligations once that closing date was met, and in order to preclude one of those three entities from exercising the termination rights, which I want to get into in a second, it needed to come to the table with whatever purchase price it could in order to avoid my client having the right to exercise its termination rights.
Let's talk about that. Even if we assumed that you may be correct on this, you know, there are three contracts as opposed to one, you started off by saying, and we came to the termination date, and through no fault of our own, Green River couldn't come to the table with the money. What do we do with the judge's findings that there was evidence that Green River's inability to finance this was directly related to the lack of consents by at least NCPI?
Right. Yes, yes, Mark.
And what do we do with that?
So I think there's two different, we have to break that into two different buckets or two different categories. With respect to NCP 7 and NCP 8, because there was absolutely no finding that either of those two entities had done any action, inaction, breach, or failed to fulfill a condition, then with respect to those two entities, they both had the right under both Section 8.1.3A and 8.1.4B to exercise their termination rights once the March 31 date hit. And therefore, the injunction, again, reviewed de novo, because this is contract interpretation, was in error, should be reversed and vacated. Now let's turn to NCPI, because the court did find that NCPI, which was the smaller of the three transactions, was not a publicly traded limited partnership, and therefore NCPI did not have the condition to go get the limited partner approval, more or less as an aside, but I wanted to put the context onto this issue. So when we look at NCPI, the court said there are three municipalities. The consent for this transfer was required, and that it does, at least in its verbal recitation at the conclusion of the first hearing, state that there might have, that might have been an impact on the ability of Green River to bring forth its
financing. It says in its written order financing. As well.
I believe you are correct, Ron, although I had been more focused on the way he articulated it at the hearing. But I want to break that into a couple pieces. One is that with respect to that factual finding, there isn't any evidence. And this, of course, is viewed on a abuse of discretion standard. But the evidence that the court pointed to was Green River's expert, who was an attorney who had come in and opined that consent would be required. And to take a step back, my client's position, NCPI's position, was that those three consents were not required because of an assignment clause within the franchise agreements with those three entities. My client, and a couple points. One is, if you look at the contract, the NCPI contract, it specifically says, here are all of the franchises that are going to be transferred in Schedule 3.4. If you go to Schedule 3.4.
Did you make this argument to the trial court, by the way, that there was an assignment right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It was a major part of the argument. We argued there was no breach here because it's not required legally. Section 3.8 of the NCPI contract lists those franchises for which a consent was required. And if you're looking through the record and the emails, the consent is called a Section 341 agreement, or it's 341. So that's what you'll see. 341s are required. And so the parties are emailing back and forth throughout their due diligence, or throughout the period between the entry of the agreements and the closing date. Do you have the 341 for this, that, and the other? And we have in the record the email where the counsel for Green River asks Northland, hey, do you have the 341 for those three entities? Green River writes back, it's not required because of the assignment clause, and the outside counsel responds, perfect, thanks. So this issue was known months before the issue of the financing came to be.
Okay, let's assume that, you know, you may not prevail on that issue. We get down to March 31st, and there is evidence in the record, I believe, that the senior lender would not have provided the loan in the absence of those consents.
If you are correct, and I want to address that, because I want to be clear, just to get to brass tacks here. If you're correct that there's sufficient evidence in the record to support that finding, then with respect to NCPI, I think that we have a pretty tough argument that they had the ability to terminate under both of those two provisions. However, the evidence is, there isn't actual evidence in the record that the senior lender would have not provided the funds regardless of the issue that Your Honor has raised with respect to these three consents. Mr. Lee was the expert. He came in and he testified that he had been engaged to provide an opinion, and that he was of the belief that these three consents would be required. However, he went on to say he hadn't provided his opinion, never provided it, and there was no evidence presented, in absence of evidence, that, in, that indeed the senior letter wouldn't have gone ahead forward and allowed closing to occur with the absence of those three consents, regardless of what Mr. Lee's opinion might have been had he rendered it, because, for example, and we put this in our brief, under Georgia law, there's a very perfunctory process through which Green River could have obtained those franchises itself. So it was, I guess, a 40, 45-day process. Green River agreed to do so with respect to certain other franchises. And so the only evidence in the record is that this still, this transaction still could have gone forward, even in the absence of those consents, even if Green River was correct that they were required. The only evidence...
Is Green River, under the terms of the agreement, required to go to all that trouble? Isn't that the seller's responsibility?
And the seller can do it. The seller can...
So you're saying Green River could have waived all this stuff and closed. Well, I guess that's always true.
And it is. But in addition to waiver, they could have, through this other statutory process, obtained those three consents. And actually, my client would be...
At their expense.
I think my client would have been the prompter in order to make that happen.
Why didn't your client do it?
They didn't believe that they needed to, and particularly on reliance on that email exchange that I described earlier, and based on the assignment language that's contained right within those three
franchises.
What's
the irreparable damage here?
I'm sorry?
What's the irreparable damage? Normally you don't get injunctive relief unless you can show irreparable damage, and this seems like a classic instance where damages might make everybody whole.
And that was, Your Honor, that was a big issue at the trial court. It's not one that has been pressed heavily on appeal, and I guess in part because we think the other arguments and the legal arguments and the de novo review is stronger. But I would add, but let me put the context. The trial judge found that because some of these cable systems had real property, there are pole agreements, there are what they call head ends, which are these, I don't understand the industry, but I understand that's where the technology comes up to the ground, and there's leases and there's easements that are obtained and things of that nature. And because this is a rural area of the country where it's difficult to have a barrier, there's economic barrier to entry, therefore these specific assets are unique enough to fall under that category of real property being entitled to specific performance or irreparable harm if you're not allowed to go forward and buy these properties. So that's what the trial court found. We don't agree that we agree with Your Honor that this there is an adequate remedy at law. It's money damages if they can prove what they lost by not being able to go forward with the deal. Where this really comes up, I think, is in connection with the second injunction, because with respect to the second injunction, we're talking now. The judge, my client went ahead without waiver and got those three consents. The other side waived all other consents and said, okay, now the triggering events for this deal and a closing date are in place. And then the court took issue with, and Green River raised, the purchase price or the subscriber rate increases that had taken place. This is fully briefed, so you get the background in our briefs, but which resulted in an increase in the purchase price. And the trial court then, at a second hearing, which was essentially, it's a new injunction. This is essentially a new injunction, and the trial court didn't even find irreparable harm. And we do brief this pretty heavily, or we brief this in our papers before Your Honor, because what the court did is said, well, I found that the inability to buy constitutes irreparable harm, and never connected that to a finding, nor was there competent evidence to support one, even if the court had such a finding, that the purchase price adjustment impacted Green River's ability to buy at that point. The evidence was to the contrary. As Mr. Udy testified, I could go get the financing to close this deal right now. I just don't want to because I'm going to use the injunction.
You're getting down to a minute. Do you want to reserve
the time? I want to complete your answer to the question. So
okay.
I'm in a position to do it, but I want to, now I get this injunction, I'm going to try to keep getting better terms until I get forced to the table, so to speak.
Counsel, let me ask a question. As I understand it, there is no evidence that the junior Lindor would have been influenced by the consents, okay? What evidence, if any, is there in the record of what was needed in terms of financing, in terms of senior versus junior or a combined, to close these three? Could there have been a closing on less than three? And if so, to what extent would the junior lender have been involved?
I'm going to struggle pointing you to direct places in the record, although it's there. I believe that the junior lender had $14 million of the purchase price. Therefore, if you look at the purchase price with respect to NCP 7 and NCP 8, they could have closed one but not the other with the senior lender, I believe is the way the numbers run.
Okay.
In connection with the second hearing, there was a lot more detail, and that record, which is also before Your Honor, provides, for example, big spreadsheets where they were locking down the different numbers. And there's testimony, we quoted it, where the Green River folks said that they had an additional $800,000 to absorb the purchase price, which they knew about.
But I gather that they could have closed on the NC, whatever, without the numbers. Okay.
NCPI, right.
Okay. Without the use of or the necessity for calling upon the junior lender, am I correct?
NCPI, yes, because that was only a $3 million part of the transaction.
So, in fact, they didn't have the junior lender would not have affected the ability to close on the NC, whatever the smaller one was.
Correct.
Don't go away.
Okay.
Your time's still not running yet, so I
still
have a question for you. In your briefs, you argued that the court somehow improperly converted conditions of closing into conditions of termination. You couldn't terminate until you satisfy the condition for closing. I'm not sure how it, if it comes down to these consents, I'm not sure what the difference is going to be, because that may come down to whether it's related to the ability to finance. But could you unpack this, how they converted the conditions of closing into conditions of termination?
Yes.
How it was improper?
Yes, although it's going to take me a minute, if that's okay.
Fine.
If we look at section 8.1.3 and 8.1.4, which permit termination, 8.1.3A and 8.1.4B both state that the opportunity to, or the ability to terminate, arise when conditions fail. If you look at the conditions which are set forth in section 6, they are conditions on the buyer's obligation to go forward and buy on the one hand, or conditions on the seller's obligation to come forward and sell on the other. They are not obligations or covenants or agreements that I'm going to do something. And so when the court said Northland can only terminate after it has satisfied its conditions, that is misstating a condition, which is Green River's obligation to buy, which Green River, we don't submit that Green River had an obligation to buy here. What we do submit, and nor are we arguing, nor have we made any claims that Green River breached I shouldn't say that there was a counterclaim, but it's not before you are. The Green River breached when it failed to come forward with the purchase price. But what we are saying is that a condition on which we had to sell, which was their tendering of the purchase price, didn't happen. Didn't happen on the closing date, and it didn't happen on the agreed to March 31 date because of the failure of a condition, 8.1.3 and 8.1.4. Point with A and B triggered our right to terminate, but to say that we had to comply with a condition is turning condition into covenant.
I was going to say, I thought the problem was that the court said you had to comply with your condition, and meaning like you had to get the consents before you could terminate.
And the only way that would make sense is if that instead of the word condition, if we said we had to comply with our obligation or our covenant. And that's why we say the court's switching or making a condition on Green River's obligation to close a covenant or an obligation on us to obtain those consents. And if you look at the way the contract reads, Section 5 sets forth our obligations, our covenants. And in Section 5.5, it addresses the consent issue and specifically says we have to make application and use reasonably commercial efforts to obtain. And there was no argument that we didn't do those things. By the way, consents is specifically defined as those listed in Schedule 3.8. So we complied with our obligation, and nobody's come forward and said, you know, we breached by not that there was a breach. Or at least when you look at the termination rights,
right.
It's the failure of a condition.
So your thought is then this consent really comes down to whether or not there was an interference with the financing.
I think that's absolutely pivotal. That there has to be sufficient evidence that And again, it can only be with NCPI, first of all, because of the integration clause. And then second is, yes, there has to be competent evidence, which we submit and I argue in our briefs is not there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, we are a court of equity, among other things. I'm going to ask the bailiff to give you 18 minutes. That's the good news.
I don't know if that's good news or bad news, depending on how hard you are.
The bad news is that I'm going to give counsel for the appellant a minute and a half rebuttal.
I think that's certainly appropriate, Your Honor. May it please the court. First of all, my name is Luke McFarland, and as you know, I represent Green River Media and ABV Cable Georgia. I'll refer to them collectively as Green River, and I will refer to the defendants collectively as Northland, unless it makes sense to break them up into the individual entities, which it will at some point. Funny you should mention the additional time allocated for argument, because my thought as I prepared for today was that I always have a desire to step up here in front of you and say, Your Honors, this is a simple case, and try to make it real easy. And I just didn't think I could get up here with a straight face and do that today, because it's a tremendously complicated case. Obviously, it's an asset purchase of some $30 million. My clients have spent over $1.2 million, not including legal fees, trying to get to this point. We're obviously appealing from two separate preliminary injunctions. We're appealing a variety of distinct but obviously interrelated issues, multiple and disputed standards of review, et cetera, et cetera. But all of that said, there is one particular issue which hasn't been talked about yet today that actually cuts through all of the complexity that's involved. And that issue is the 15-day cure period. Because no matter how you come out on the other issues before you, it's more or less undisputed. You can look at the termination letters. It's more or less undisputed that there wasn't a cure period provided. Defendants simply terminated the deals and didn't provide any. What they should have done is said, here's the breaches we're claiming or the failures we're claiming. You have 15 days to cure.
Well, that's interesting, because I guess two things. I guess they would say that that there was no right to cure because of the way in which the contract is structured. So I'd like you to address that.
Absolutely.
The second thing I'd like you to address is the contract doesn't say you have to give notice, further notice of your right to cure. It says you have to give notice of the deficiency, and then there's a 15-day right to cure. In other words, my question is, why didn't you have to do something in that 15 days, regardless of whether or not they gave you notice of your right that's already in the contract?
Absolutely, and I'll address both in the order you raised them. The first is whether the cure provision applies in this situation. And I think if you'll read through the cure provision, which I'm sure you've already done, you'll see that. It's very broad. It's at the end of the document. It says, for all purposes under this agreement, the existence or occurrence of any event or circumstance that constitutes a breach of a representation or warranty, or the non-fulfillment of any pre-closing covenant or agreement of buyer or seller contained in this agreement, et cetera, requires a cure right.
Is there a condition or covenant? Is a condition or covenant?
I believe that a condition is the same thing as a pre-closing covenant or agreement. It's something you agree to do before the closing can happen. And this section clearly says any pre-closing covenant or agreement.
But it has to be a promise, does it not?
I think it is a promise. I think
the condition is a promise?
It's a promise that you'll get these things done before the closing happens.
Let me ask a similar question. Does the 15-day cure provision apply to a failure to close?
I absolutely believe it does.
So that it is an automatic 15-day extension of the closing date?
I think that's essentially correct. And to dovetail with that and to return to Judge Daly's second question, well, first of all, let me say that whether this is a failure of a condition or a breach is really a red herring. Northland is arguing now that it's not a breach, it's just a failure of a condition when we didn't show up to closing with the money. Now, it's telling that if you look at their counterclaims in this action, they actually assert a counterclaim for breach of contract. And that, it's in paragraph 38 of their counterclaims, it says, quote, the failure of Green River to provide the purchase price by March 31st, 2008 constituted a breach of the agreements. So their argument now that it's not a breach, it's just a condition, again, it's really a red herring, is inconsistent with their position earlier in this litigation. So again, the termination clause is very broad. Now, as to Judge Daly's second question, did we have an obligation to just go out and cure, sort of regardless of any affirmative opportunity, hey, you guys can go out and cure?
Yeah, no, it's actually is, does the contract require not only a notice of deficiency, but a notice of the right to cure, part one. Part two is, if it doesn't, what prevented you from doing anything in that 15 days?
Right. First of all, I would argue that it does require that you can't just terminate the contract. You have to say, it says that the termination isn't effective until there's been written notice of a deficiency and opportunity to cure. So I think the way that it should work is we should have gotten a letter that said, here's your notice of deficiency, you have 15 days to cure, and if we didn't cure, it would be terminated.
Why do you need the notice of 15 days to cure if it's in the contract? It's a contract, right, independently enforceable. And why do you need a notice of deficiency when they send you a letter and says, you haven't paid, we're ending this contract?
Fair question, and here's why. The real issue here is that not only did they not sort of affirmatively provide this cure period, they also took actions which prevented Green River from curing. What they did is immediately upon termination, they filed 8-Ks, publicly available, indicating to the world that these deals were terminated. They made no reference of any cure right and of no possibility for us to go out and cure.
How does that impact your ability to perform?
You read my mind. Green River's president, Patrick Udy, testified at the preliminary injunction hearing that, one, this is a small community of bankers. So when he goes out to get replacement funding during that cure period, it's a handful of people that you're going to go to who will actually fund these very complex cable acquisition deals because they're very unique. When he goes out there to those people, and he testified that he did this, he went out there, and these people all said, well, and I think the word he used was scuttlebug, but they had all heard that the deal was off. And these folks have limited resources. There's a lot of due diligence to do, and it would have to be done in a short time period to determine if they could step in and fund the deal. And when you go to these folks and you say, listen, we've got 15 days to get this funding. We want you to take a close look at this. The first thing that they see is that the other party has filed statements saying this deal is off. There's no way we're selling these assets, no way, no how. There's no cure period, et cetera. It makes it impossible for us to have any realistic chance of curing.
Counsel, let me ask you this question. Was there testimony that you had lost the senior lender as well as the junior?
My understanding of the testimony was that the senior lender would not have closed without the consents. The senior lender was still in place and still ready to go, but it did still need those consents before it could be in a position to close.
And what testimony was this? From whom?
That was the testimony, I believe, of Mr. Lee.
Right. What about the arguments, though, that, well, this was an undisclosed opinion of Mr. Lee, who was not a representative of the senior lender, but instead an attorney for, I guess, Green River?
Correct. First of all, the court allowed him to testify as to those points, and his testimony was really in the nature of, again, his experience as in this industry and what it takes to get these deals done, whether or not these deals would close without these types of consents, et cetera. And my recollection of the record is that the court actually made a finding that such testimony would be helpful to the court's understanding of this very sort of complex and intricate area of law.
Counsel, one last question on the right to cure issue, and I think you're going to be somewhat frustrated when I ask it. They never really said that they never took issue with you were prevented with your right to cure during that 15-day period, did they, in their briefs?
Did they say about
the applicability of the right to cure provision, but they didn't turn around and say, but you didn't show you were denied your opportunity to cure.
I believe that's correct, absolutely correct. They never took issue with the court's finding, which is, quote, defendants ignored the cure right by wrongfully making a public announcement in an SEC 8K filing that the agreements were terminated without mentioning any right to cure. And that was very helpful, not frustrating at all.
Well, upon reflection, you'll think it was frustrating we had you on 3 minutes on this conversation.
I'll move on, if you're ready, to some of the other additional issues raised by Northland in this appeal. First thing I'd like to talk about is the first thing that my esteemed colleague, Mr. McPhee, spoke about, and that's whether these contracts should be treated as a single transaction or as three totally separate independent contracts. Certainly this was presented by Judge Naves at the trial court level as a factual finding. It's under a heading that says factual findings, that these were contemplated and to be treated as one singular transaction. There was ample evidence for that. The intent of the parties, again, there was a single term sheet at the very outset. They sat down and said, in writing, we agree that this will be treated as one singular transaction.
But counsel, if it's an integrated contract and unambiguous, that factual finding is irrelevant, isn't it?
I don't believe so. And
can a trial court rely upon extrinsic evidence if the contract is unambiguous?
Generally, no, but I believe there's an exception to that rule, which is contained in the case Bledsoe versus Hill, and there's actually a ton of these cases in Colorado. That's 747 P. Second 10. It's Colorado Court of Appeals, 1987.
Is this in your brief, by the way?
This is not, and the reason it's not is because the ambiguousness argument was first presented in the reply.
Okay.
But I'd like to bring it to your attention.
What's the full Bledsoe brief?
Bledsoe v. Hill.
Hill.
747 P. Second 10. And it's a short case, but what this case says, I'll quote it, if a simultaneously executed agreement between the same parties relating to the same subject matter is contained in more than one instrument, the documents must be construed together to determine intent as though the entire agreement were contained in a single document.
But these were not the same parties, were they?
They were all Northland entities on one hand, and they were all Green River entities on the other.
Well, did you present, was there any evidence that would allow the corporate veil to be pierced?
There was no corporate veil evidence, but if you look at this line of cases, what you'll see is that when you have related parties on either side and the same essential subject matter, if you have one transaction, which is broken down into three contracts, what this case law says is that you must consider those together.
Do you think this case stands for the proposition that you can ignore the formalities of the way in which the parties have chosen to structure the agreement, and because they expected it to go forward on one occasion?
I think that's you're phrasing it a little differently than I would, but I think that in essence that is what these cases say. And I'll just finish the quote, which is, although it is desirable for the documents to refer to each other, there is no requirement that they do so. And what this line of cases really says, if you flip through them, is that what we're not going to ignore is when the parties sit down and say, we're going to create a single transaction, all of these will close together, which is explicit in the letter of intent. And both parties, really throughout the whole course of their actions, act with that intent as well. And it's not just one party saying this is one transaction, not three. It's really both throughout the course of dealing.
You've referred to a line of cases. Do you have a case that you could give us now that relates to different parties and numerous contracts?
I don't, but I would argue, given the fact that these are all essentially the same management, the same essentially the same companies, that it would be fair under this line of cases to treat them in the same basket.
But again, I think, as the judge asked, there was no finding about piercing the corporate veil that they are in essence one party.
Well, there was a finding that the exact factual finding was that these were considered to be one singular transaction. So I would argue that the court actually made the requisite factual finding that puts this circumstance into this Bledsoe line of cases.
But you have different owners, don't you? You have two separate limited partnerships.
That's correct. That's
completely
correct.
Separate, different owners.
You have the same, exactly, that's right. Different,
you
essentially shareholders.
You may have a common general partner that, what, owns 1%?
Correct, and sort of runs the show. But you do have different.
Isn't there evidence that basically they will run as one business?
Absolutely.
I mean, There may be an accounting at the end between the partnerships, but basically they were advertised, presented themselves, and operated as one business.
That's exactly right. And to move on and not spend too much time on this, but they, I really would, at the end of the day, submit that this whole issue is irrelevant for a couple of reasons. I think the court's finding is correct, but ultimately I don't think it matters to your decision. One reason is because of the cure issue. And even if two of these entities had the right to terminate, and we're going to say Green River was obligated to terminate, or obligated to pay, and they didn't, so these two entities could terminate, they still didn't provide this cure right, and they still inhibited any right of any ability by us to cure. Additionally, the court never truly addressed the issue of whether NC-7 and NC-8 were actually in compliance. Now, counsel has said that they were in compliance, that they stood ready to close, but actually they weren't. And the reason
was evidence presented at the hearing that they weren't?
There was not, and the reason there wasn't.
How can the court address it if there's no evidence presented? How could you base a preliminary injunction on evidence that's not presented?
They can't. Well, you can't, because what the court did was say these are all one transaction, and I have found that there are three consents missing, therefore Green River was not obligated to close. The court did not perform an individual analysis because it made that initial holding that these were one transaction as to what each of the three entities were.
Did you attempt to present evidence that there was noncompliance by the other two?
There actually was evidence on that front, although it was not a focus of the hearing because of the court's initial ruling.
The court didn't make the finding before you presented the evidence and argument. The court makes its finding after you present the evidence and argument. So who put the focus on noncompliance by NCPI?
That was the focus because, again, everyone was treating these as a single transaction. However, there was evidence presented by Mr. Hunter, who's on behalf of Green River, who said there were various other breaches there were various other consents from these other entities that would need to be cleaned up before closing. But in fairness, did testify that they didn't think that that would be a major stumbling block, that we could work through these issues. But as of March 31st, the other entities weren't in compliance, but that's an issue that the court would need to. If you find that these are three separate contracts and you find that that they complied with the cure provision, it would have to be sent back for additional factual findings as to whether NC-7 and NC-8 were in compliance and could terminate properly as of March 31st.
Additional findings or additional hearing and findings with another opportunity to present evidence of noncompliance by NC-7 and NC-8?
I believe it would be additional hearings and evidence.
Why? You had an opportunity to present the evidence upon which you wish to have a preliminary injunction once.
That evidence, as I said, was presented, and it didn't make it into the court's finding because it wasn't focused on and it wasn't necessary to the court's finding.
Who was the witness who testified to that?
Stephen Hunter.
Let me ask one question. Did these three entities share facilities such that one could not operate without the other in terms of service to the customers?
My understanding is that they were all done through a central billing structure.
No, I mean providing service. Did one own the dish and the other one own the means of conveying the signal? Or could they provide their services? If you bought one, you could fully provide service to the customers of that entity.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know that evidence was provided to that effect.
I see a red light after 18 minutes.
Hey, all right. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
I hate to suddenly force time on this, but you have a minute and a half, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Wait until we get it on the clock. Go.
Thank you. I'm glad that opposing counsel brought up the cure period and the 15-day notice. It's the same issue that we talked about when I was earlier on covenant versus condition, and as the direct language of section 10.15 provides, it is a notice to cure when there's been a breach or a failure of an obligation, but not when there's been a failure of a condition. Second, and probably the best evidence when you read these contracts, is that under those termination provisions, one that we haven't talked about allows for termination by either party if the other side is in material breach, but it specifically references the right to cure and specifically references section 10.15 because that makes sense. That is under the breach.
Counsel, I have a little bit of problems with your distinction between promise and condition here, because the matter of consent is actually a promissory condition, isn't it? Didn't your client agree to use best efforts to get consents?
That is the obligation, correct,
yes,
Your Honor.
And that could be breached.
But there's 2 points. One is it agreed to use its best efforts to obtain the consents from the municipalities listed in Schedule 3.8. These three that are at issue are not on that schedule.
Okay.
So that's point one. And point two is there wasn't any evidence that my client didn't do what it needed to do commercially reasonable efforts. The evidence was he just hadn't gotten them.
Okay.
So that's one point I definitely wanted to raise. Number two, with respect to the new case that I did not, may I continue? I've run out of time.
Any answer about the new case, Judge? It might be helpful.
What do you want to take a vote? Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may briefly address Bledsoe versus Hill.
First of all, as counsel read, I haven't seen the case, but as counsel read the case, it does pertain to the same parties, number one. Number two, I bet, but haven't looked at this because it wasn't argued before the court, it wasn't found by the lower court, it wasn't found by the lower court, and it wasn't presented in the briefing, but even if Your Honors were to consider it, that line of cases, I'm willing to bet, doesn't say it trumps express terms in the contract. Here, the parties expressly stated in their merger and integration clause that each of these contracts supersedes prior negotiations, including specifically listing the letter of intent, which is the piece of parole evidence that the other side has addressed.
Well, counsel, I'm going to cut off your statement, and I'm going to give each party 10 days to submit a letter addressed directly to the division, not to exceed 2 pages in length, discussing the impact, if any, of Bledsoe versus Hill on this case. And you can discuss its progeny and its predecessors, obviously.
One other point that I was hoping to raise.
No, the red light's on.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. We appreciate your argument. You were correct in saying at the outset that it's a difficult case, and I admire your ability to remember the section numbers and subsection numbers because I've read the contract and I get lost in it very, very quickly. I realize you've had more time with it than I have. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. And the court will stand in recess, subject to call, and the bailiff may so announce.
All right. The court will be in recess, subject to call.